This is WWJBC This Week.
Let's stop wasting time by voting on spending bills you know must be vetoed.
We saved the state so much money by people being able to be in their home that, you know, let's see him cut the nursing homes that he owns.
This is pretty much a scam. I don't think we're talking about false promises at all.
We have no illusions that that everyone's going to be supportive of the project.
They should be doing everything they possibly can to reduce smoking prevalence rates.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, developers proposed $51 million hotel and conference center downtown faces scrutiny from the Bloomington City Council. We'll hear from two aldermen with opposing viewpoints. Supreme Court expert Bob Bradley reflects on the impact of Justice Antonin Scalia and what happens to the court now following Scalia's death. Illinois State University President Larry Dietz discusses the state budget stalemate and its impact on the university. Plus, the man behind the Miracle on the Hudson shares his story ahead of his Evening of Stars visit in April. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Bloomington aldermen spent about 3 hours meeting this week to review a consultant's report on the proposed $51 million downtown hotel and conference center, a plan that's been narrowed down from the proposal the city council chose not to consider last year. A portion of that money, according to the proposal from developer Jeff Gabelhausen, would come from tax rebates from the city. The panel didn't take any action, but the council is expected to vote next month on a plan to study the specific financial risks. Gabelhausen talked with WJBC's Joe Ragusa after the meeting.
So what specifically about the council meeting tonight would you pull away from where the council is leaning on this sort of issue?
I don't try and read what city councils are, think or how they're going to vote or anything like that. The reality of it is it is an important project for downtown. Something has to happen to continue to move downtown forward, and we think this is the right project.
And certainly, there, I know there were some concerns about revenue projections not hitting what they're projected to be at, and certainly that's a risk when you look at any possible development, right?
Right. We just echoed. The city's not going to own the hotel. The city's not going to own the conference center. It's nothing like the BCPA. It's nothing like the Coliseum. So, you know, revenues are going to be higher some years. They're going to be lower some years. But that's all private sector risk.
But certainly based on the kinds of bonds that they might actually seek out for this kind of thing, their level of risk could be different.
Yeah, absolutely. The city's consultant did a good job of laying out the spectrum for the city in terms of what the city's involvement may or may not be, and we'll have discussions in the future exactly how it needs to be structured.
So what happens next from your perspective? I know that they're going to vote on an inducement resolution, I guess, next month, and that'll actually be a formal action regarding your next step. But what happens now?
Well, we'll continue to work on the project every day, and that's what we do. We continue to try and figure out how to make it better for everyone, including the city. We'll continue to do that, and we'll look forward to having the inducement resolution so we can work toward finalization of the project.
And one thing that's kind of up in the air, well, there's probably several things kind of up in the air regarding this, but one thing that I noticed hasn't really been talked about a lot is that the actual hotel, or hotelier, however you want to say it, is still an unknown to this point. So where is that process?
It's not an unknown to us.
Okay, so you have a name in mind?
We know who we're dealing with. We know what the flag is. We just aren't prepared to share that publicly.
Why would there be? Why would that be worth keeping secret?
Because,
or not necessarily keep secret, but keep away from public.
Because we don't know if there's a project yet. If we release that name, every other city that's looking for a hotel, every other city that's looking for a hotelier is going to get on the phone and call. Why would we create our own competition? It doesn't make any sense.
Well, certainly they already know the competition's out there. I mean, it's not like what would the competition be like if you were to make it public?
It serves no purpose. We don't know what the deal is with the city. Until we have a better parameter of what the deal is, one of our hotel prospects that we've been dealing with may not be interested. The deal that the city wants to do may not work for them. We may have to go to option two or option three. So we're not going to sit here and say, you know, we've got this spectrum of options, but we do. We've got a number of options. We have our lead candidate. We'd like to get them over the finish line, but that's going to depend upon the final agreement with the city.
So is anything actually signed or dotted or anything like that? Are they fully go in this, or is it still kind of up in the air?
Well, it's certainly still up in the air because we don't know what the deal is with the city. But there's a strong level of interest. They've done their market research. They certainly are prepared to do a deal if we can get to the right structure of the deal.
At what point do you feel like naming the actual hotelier would be something that would happen? Would it be with the inducement resolution? Would it be further down the line?
It'll be further down the line after the inducement resolution. It will be after they go and produce their financing and all of their, you know, capital stack, their equity, and other sources, and then we'll be prepared for the council to be able to announce who they are.
And it was 7-1 as far as the proposal to at least move forward with this. It's not a binding vote or anything like that, and it wasn't the inducement resolution even. But certainly 7-1 with one council member absent is a pretty good sign, I imagine.
Well, we're pleased. I mean, you know, we have no illusions that that everyone's going to be supportive of the project. We are disappointed that sometimes there's comments negative about the project that just don't make any sense whatsoever. And we'll do our best to try to point that out whenever we can.
And, of course, we're talking about when you say that kind of stuff. I mean, the $13 million that are being asked for, it's not like it would be $13 million right up front.
Right. It's not $13 million right up front, but the suggestion that that money ought to go into the streets is just an illogical comment, because there is no money if the project doesn't generate the money. So how can you suggest that that money should be spent somewhere else if, in fact, the money doesn't exist?
So going back to the hotelier kind of discussion, as far as your confidence in regards to their involvement in this kind of project, I mean, are they just waiting on the city, or are there other variables at play here?
No, the primary wait is what is the structure of a potential deal with the city.
Well, you say primary.
The primary.
So is that it?
Well, I'd never suggest that that's the only issue. I mean, but that is certainly the primary issue.
Well, what other issues, what other variables could there be in regards to this? I mean, if the city's involved, is there a possibility that they could still drop out of the proposal?
Well, there's certainly, as we continue to work through the finalization of the construction costs. I mean, for example, we're dealing with two historic buildings. These construction costs are the best estimates right now of the contractors, the architects, other developers. Clearly, if we find that we have a budget bust, yeah, there would be no project because it wouldn't make economic sense.
When you say project bust, I mean, depending on when you find out how long the line, if the costs would be dramatically different, what would that mean for the city?
We would know that before the city's ever hard into a deal. Between the city entering into an inducement resolution and there being a final vote, we will know the answers to those questions.
But wouldn't they already be working on a TIF district and that kind of thing? They'd already be sort of working on economic incentives for this thing to work out. Granted, those things could be there as well for any other property, but still, it's not necessarily like they're not doing anything.
No, I mean, the city would have some process beginning. But that really is what they need to do. They need to begin the process. We've spent 2.5 years working on this project. It'd be nice to see the city, you know, continue to work on it as well.
That was developer Jeff Gabelhausen with Joe Ragusa. Bloomington Alderwoman Amelia Burgess says the city must take a cautious approach as it examines the proposal that would use tax rebates to help with financing. She talked with WJBC's Scott Lachlan this week.
Well, how about the private entity? If they're so gung-ho on this being successful, just foot the bill for all of it.
That'd be wonderful. But again, so we are looking to reduce our risk. So is the private entity. The private entity also would like to reduce their risk. They're coming into, to some extent, an untested market. Obviously, Bloomington has a lot of factors that would make it very appealing to developers and to people who want to invest in the community. But downtown is not yet fully revitalized. So there's some degree of risk for them. They would like to minimize it. And it's all about a negotiation. Where can we feel most comfortable, and where can the people we partner with feel most comfortable that this is a deal that will be successful and be a good return on the investment for everyone involved.
Talking with Amelia Burgess, Bloomington City Councilwoman, 20 minutes after 7 at WJBC. Here's a phrase you hear time and time again, throwing good money after bad money. Bloomington has been working on downtown redevelopment for, I think, as long as I've been here, in one way, shape, or form. I think maybe I watch every one of these city council meetings, and I've heard, you know, enough is enough already, throwing good money after bad money. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, this passes. They build this thing, and it doesn't meet expectations. then the question is, okay, now is it enough? You know what, Amelia here, and Colleen's not here to justify. Laura will. I go through life. I go through life, and my wife will tell you. I go through life thinking worst case scenario. That way, I'm never disappointed. You know, I told you it was going to happen. You know that way. So that's the way I like the idea. I mean, if I would love to see this come to downtown Bloomington and succeed, but we've tried a couple of different things, and it's if we just do one more thing, then that's going to be it. And is it always going to be just one more thing?
Well, I think any area of the city, including downtown, will always be evolving. And I think there's nothing wrong with always saying, how can we make it better? What should we change? That's not a sign of failure or the sign that what you've already done has not worked. It's just saying that it's a continuing evolution of downtown. So we want to preserve our older buildings. We want new businesses to come in. We want existing businesses to succeed. All of that is part of a living, breathing city. And that's okay. But again, I'd return to this idea that, to me, the worst case scenario is we do nothing. We allow these properties to continue to be vacant. I mean, the front and center building takes up half a city block, and there's nothing going on there. It's empty. That is a vastly underutilized property. The Commerce Bank building, it does have an anchor tenant, but the majority of the building is not being used. The same with the Elks building. It's empty. We have a surface parking lot, which is not the most efficient use of that space. If we're going to have parking, a parking structure gets a whole lot more spaces on the same footprint. So this is about taking property to a higher and better use.
What do you
and
think?
At the end of the day, I don't think we're going that. That is the best way to move forward.
What do you think of Kevin Lauer's statement that he's worried that you're just going to be robbing Peter to pay Paul? Part of the plan of this hotel is to have, what was it, 3 restaurants in it?
It's going to be a combination of restaurants and bars.
And what would that do? And what the question is, what would that do to, the locals, the mom and pops that are downtown? I mean, is that going to cut into their business? I would imagine it's going to.
That would be the concern, and it's a very valid concern. It's great to bring that up to make sure we're continuing to look at that. And no one wants to bring in a new business that would harm an existing business, because we've got a lot of great businesses in downtown Bloomington, some great restaurants that are very, very busy. No, right now our consultants are telling us that based on the information they have, which, again, this can change over time, which is why we need to, move forward very cautiously. Based on the information they have, they believe that the revenue projections are primarily, if not wholly, new revenue. So they're not tapping into an existing revenue stream. They're not taking business from someone else in these calculations, and they believe that the data they're looking at supports this conclusion, that a majority of the business will be business that it'll be a market that has not yet been tapped. Mm-hmm. Now, they can't guarantee that exclusively because, there's nothing,
right.
these are projections and estimates.
And,
but that is something we will continue to look at as we move forward and really challenge those assumptions to make sure that this is tapping into something that does not previously exist.
That was Bloomington Alderwoman Amelia Burgess with Scott Laughlin. One outspoken critic of the plan on the city council is Kevin Lauer, and he talked with Joe Ragusa.
There's a lot of ifs that need to be answered before some of them will go much further than this, I'm sure. And I'm not sure that we've got the full picture even now, and I'm not sure we'll have it then.
Well, what concerns do you have regarding the full picture?
The whole picture is that the revenue that they're talking about, a major portion of that is very likely to come from inside the community. It's nothing that necessarily is going to be attracted from outside. We're led to believe it's all going to be new business. And if it was, I wouldn't have as big of a problem with it. But I'm afraid that we're just robbing Peter to pay Paul, just to try to force something to happen downtown. I don't think that's the thing that we ought to be doing. We're putting stress on already stressed businesses. In an economy that is not performing the way that we would like it to perform. And obviously there's a few months here before they would really make a commitment and move forward on this project. And for the labor and for the work and for, putting people to work, I would love to have something like this. But I think it needs to be, the risk needs to be borne by the private entity.
And so you're basically saying that if this were to be built downtown, it would just pull away from the existing businesses.
I'm afraid that it would be, and that is competition. But when you mix in city support for that, then you're creating unfair competition, and that's the problem that I've got.
Well, when you say unfair competition, there was the point made that a lot of the other hotels did involve public partnership, or at least some kind of public investment.
Some of them did. I'm not saying that that's right or wrong, but I am saying that I believe that private investment could probably stand on its own here, and it should, especially in this type of economy. When you're forcing other entities out of business or coming very nearly to doing that, and I think that they probably will force others out, our occupancy rates are not that high right now, and they haven't been, and they're not projected to be because of the issues that we're having with other entities that have come and gone, Mitsubishi, the changes at State Farm, et cetera. And so that market is very, very volatile right now, and it's very difficult on the folks that will continue to exist.
That was Bloomington Alderman Kevin Lauer with Joe Ragusa. The death of Antonin Scalia means that President Obama will have the opportunity to nominate a third Supreme Court justice during his presidency, one that could possibly tip the scales of the court in terms of their judicial and political philosophies. Supreme Court expert and a retired Illinois State University professor Bob Bradley talked about it with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
You've studied the court so extensively. What was the first thing you thought of?
Well, the first thing that hit me was that I was surprised. I knew that he was old. The Supreme Court before his passing was the third oldest court in American history and was closing rapidly on becoming number two. And there had been a lot of discussion in the presidential election that the next president, whoever it is, could have the possibility of appointing four justices to the Supreme Court, because there are four justices that are right around 80 years old, of which Scalia was one. But I was surprised because I hadn't heard of any health problems or anything that he was having. And then the other thing that struck me immediately was that there are some cases that are currently before the court that could be really affected by this. One of the cases that's been talked about a lot in Illinois is a case dealing with public employee unions. And right now, it looked like, before Scalia's passing, that one of the things that public employee unions do is charge fees, even of those union members that might not agree with the union stances on things. And that was in question. And it was generally held that that practice is going to be struck down 5-4 because the conservatives numbered 5 and the liberals on the court numbered 4. Well, now it would be 4-4. And it may be that public employee unions might have dodged a real bullet on that case.
When is the court scheduled to hear those arguments for that case?
It's already heard oral arguments on that case, which is why a lot of people argued that it was going to be a 5-4 decision looking into the oral argument. The decision on the case will probably come down in May, late May, early June.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the nomination process then. You already have Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and a couple of the people that are running for the Republican nomination for president say, well, President Obama should not nominate the next Supreme Court justice, that somehow the American people should weigh in on it, not the president, even though the American people did elect the president. That's a big thing that the president does, is nominate justices. Do they have an argument to say that this should be held over until we elect a new president?
No. I mean, in a very simple way, no. It does a disservice, first and foremost, to the Supreme Court, because then you put the Supreme Court in a position of making a bunch of decisions this term and a lot of decisions for next term that would be on a court without full membership of 9. Second of all, and interestingly, it would actually, in some ways, discredit Scalia. One of the things that most bothered Scalia in his decision-making is when he saw, or what he perceived to be, politics entering what the Supreme Court does. And you could see that in some of his opinions when the court dealt with the Affordable Care Act, and he thought that politics had really entered the court's decision-making there. And so I think Scalia, if he was around to comment on this, and if it had been another justice, let's say Justice Kennedy had been the one to pass away, and Justice Scalia was still on the court, I think he would be very upset that people would be using basically politics to say that the president should not fulfill his constitutional duty of making an appointment to the court.
If President Obama does nominate, well, he will nominate a candidate that has to be approved by Congress, and Congress just doesn't like the nomination, how long can they drag it out? What happens if this whole nomination process gets held up, kind of the way that a number of the appellate justice appointments and other appointments have been held up for so long by Congress?
Well, that's the very likely and unfortunate probability, is that the Senate will never convene to vote on it. And they may not even schedule confirmation hearings until the election's over. And that's not necessarily unprecedented. And there's two facets to that. First of all, President Obama has gotten a reputation of being fairly slow in filling federal judicial vacancies. He's been sort of renowned for that for his past 7 years. So on that aspect, it's going to be slow. And then the Senate certainly has not been really speedy in dealing with appointees of the presidency, particularly those appointees that might make policy or would be controversial. And both those criteria are filled when you're talking about filling Scalia's seat on the court. So it all plays out to the fact that even if Obama does make the appointment, I think he will. I think he will make an appointment. It won't be as fast as some people want, but he'll make one. The odds of the Senate actually conducting a vote, I think, are minimal at best.
That was retired ISU professor and legal scholar Bob Bradley with Steve Fast. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. While Governor Rauner called for a major increase in funding for early and K-12 education, higher education was hardly referenced in the governor's budget address this week. That leaves educators, including Illinois State University President Larry Dietz, wondering what's next. Dietz talked with WJBC's Joe Ragusa this week.
There have been talk about how everyone values higher education, but no one seems to be putting it into any bills much, and we still don't have any money. So to me, you know, if you really value something, you invest in it, and we haven't seen the investment. There are some plans, you know, that the governor has that we would hope would generate some discussions, and there are plans that other legislators have introduced into bills that we hope that would generate some discussion as well. But in the meantime, you know, people are trying to pay their bills, and that's hard to do without a budget.
And there are a lot of bills, some of them conflicting, at least, and some of them going along partisan lines. So are there any pieces of legislation that you feel could actually solve the issue or at least provide some relief to either like MAP grants or just to the higher education funding budget in general?
Well, I wouldn't. It's not really my role to endorse any particular bill. Jonathan Lackland, our director of state relations, you know, monitors that pretty directly, and there are occasions that we'll put in some slips that would indicate which ones might seem a little more favorable than others. But the bottom line is that it seems to me that there are two people who are really holding up the process, and my hope is that the governor and the speaker will get together, realize the pain that the students and their families are feeling right now, and come up with some kind of compromise that will help move this agenda ahead. Where we are right now with the impasse in the budget is really affecting current students and their families, and it's affecting students and their families who are trying to make decisions about where they're going to be enrolling for this next year. Our concern is that they may decide that they're going to be enrolling out of state because this state, at this point, is not supporting higher education.
ISU passed a budget for this year, correct, that reflects a 10% cut in state aid?
Yes.
And I know that there was at least some discussion that there could be a potential 20% cut in state aid, and obviously there have been higher numbers thrown out previously. So Is the university prepared to face a cut of 20% or even higher than that?
You know, we have plans in place. We could spend every waking hour doing budget simulations based upon who wants to submit, you know, what kind of an idea. But we have plans in place that would allow us to implement, you know, whatever the decision is of the governor and the legislature. We just simply need a decision so we can implement our plans and move on. The biggest issue to me is really stability over time. You know, the people will understand that if we have cuts, you know, how to phase that in. People understand that if you have increases in tuition, that's probably, a normalcy within that's also within a reality, I guess, of what may happen in some places. The biggest issue is the unpredictability. And so we need a figure. We need some agreement so we can get out of this malaise.
And unfortunately, I know that some lawmakers have discussed just moving ahead with the 2017 budget. And I don't know if this was their intention, but it came off that way and just kind of leave 2016 behind. And if that were the case, you could lead to the conclusion that higher education might not receive any funding. Have you gotten that kind of vibe from lawmakers at all, or is it significantly less extreme than that?
Well, you know, there's all kinds of rumors that you hear, and that's a rumor that I have heard. That would be devastating for a lot of institutions in the state of Illinois if there was no funding at all for FY16. Some of them wouldn't need to worry about FY17, because they would be so negatively impacted in 16.
I guess I'll have to ask us again in this form, but can Illinois State University survive no funding for the fiscal year?
You know, it would really deplete, a lot of the dollars that we have, but we're going to get through this fiscal year, with or without the state.
That was ISU President Larry Dietz with Joe Ragusa. Chesley Sully Sullenberger is the man behind the miracle on the Hudson. His nerves of steel handling a potentially disastrous emergency water landing of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 in the Hudson River off Manhattan in 2009 made him an instant national celebrity. He's the featured speaker at the Red Cross of the Heartland Evening of Stars on April 21st in Normal. Captain Sully shared his story with WJBC's Terry James this week.
Take us back to that day. What do you remember the most?
Just the humanity, you know, in retrospect, having had a lot of time to think about that day and everything since, it was at a time in the world's history during the 08-09 financial meltdown in which it seemed like everything was going wrong and no one could do anything right. And then this group of people on that day in that place rose to the occasion to meet this sudden ultimate challenge to see that good was done and lives were changed and saved. And I think it gave people hope at a time when we all needed it. So I think it's that rising to the occasion of everyone, crew, passengers, first responders, the New York waterway ferry operators who were there within 4 minutes to begin to rescue us, all came together and led to such a remarkably good outcome.
And just to remind folks, you were behind the controls of U.S. Airways Flight 1549 and did an emergency water landing. When you landed the plane, how sure were you that that water landing would be a success as it was?
Well, I was confident that I could find a way, based upon my experience and my training, along with my crew, to find a way to solve even this problem, which was one we'd never specifically anticipated or trained for. In fact, in our flight simulators, it's not possible to practice a water landing. Believe it or not, the only training we'd ever gotten for a water landing was a theoretical classroom discussion. So we'd never done this before, but we'd done other things that helped us to prepare. We'd learned how to build teams and create a shared sense of responsibility among all the members for the outcome. We had a very well-defined set of roles and responsibilities that we have as crew members. And so we didn't have to completely reinvent the wheel. We just had to put the last few spokes in place. So I was confident I could have ultimately find a way to solve all the problems. I just didn't know at the very outset, with this sudden conflict with the birds and the immediate loss of thrust in both engines, exactly what each step was going to be. But it's almost humorous. Once we did land, and we had stopped in the water, and the airplane was stable and intact and floating, and it was obvious that based upon the forces that we felt, everyone was still okay. And the most amazing coincidence, Jeff Skiles, our first officer, and I had turned to each other in that cockpit and took a second to say to each other, well, that wasn't as bad as I thought. But we weren't high-fiving, but it was an acknowledgement that we'd solved the first and the biggest problem of the day. But, of course, we still then had to get 155 people out of the Hudson River on a day when the air temperature was 21 and water was 38.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask you about that cockpit experience. How many people were in there? Was it just you and your co-pilot, or were there others that in the cockpit at the time? And was there calm in a time of complete, I guess, unknown of what was going to happen?
Well, there were just two of us, but that we were a team. And the interesting part is, at a large airline, in American Airlines now, which is the successor company for U.S. Airways, now has 15,000 pilots after the mergers have been completed. And what that means in practice is that we fly all the time with people we've never met before. And that was the case for me and Jeff. This happened on a Thursday afternoon, and we met for the first time on Monday of that week when we began this four-day series of trips. So if you'd been able to sit in the observer seat in our cockpit on that flight to the river, not that you would really have wanted to be there with us, I grant you, you would have thought that we'd been working together like that for years because we'd been trained to such a high professional standard and we knew our roles and responsibilities so well. But having said that, we only had, as it turned out, 208 seconds from the time we hit the birds and lost thrust in both engines until we had landed in the river. So it was an incredibly intense experience.
Again, we're talking with Captain Solly Sullenberger, who is known for the miracle on the Hudson, the water landing in New York City's Hudson River. We often hear of the pilot making announcements to folks that are on the plane. Do you remember the first words you said to those that were passengers on Flight 1549?
Oh, I do. I remember them vividly. And, of course, we now have the benefit of having the transcript of the cockpit voice recorder, so what I said has been verified. I knew it was going to be the most important announcement of my life. I understood even in those immediate moments that this was going to be the challenge of a lifetime, and I would be second-guessed as part of the National Transportation Safety Board's investigation. They would validate our understanding of the situation, validate that each choice we made at every juncture was the one that led to the best outcome. That's their job. So I wanted to identify myself as the decision maker. I wanted to sound confident and not agitated. And I chose two specific words for equally specific reasons. At our airline and others, in our wonderful aviation vocabulary, there are certain single words that are rich with meaning. Brace is such a word that triggers, in the flight attendants, their actions. It warns them that emergency landing is imminent and that they should help the passengers avoid injury during a landing so that they could be able to evacuate. And then in the spur of the moment, I chose a word that we were then not trained to use, but they are now, to give them a vivid word picture, an image of what to expect, that without engine thrust, using gravity to provide the forward motion of the airplane, we were coming down very rapidly, the equivalent of being in a hotel elevator and descending 2 floors per second. I knew it was going to be a hard landing. I just didn't know how hard. So I said, this is the captain, brace for impact. And that's all I had time to say. Jeff and I never even had a chance to have a conversation about what had happened. I had to rely upon him immediately and intuitively understanding this developing situation as I did. So I didn't have time to tell everyone the whole picture, but I had time only to set the wheels in motion so that we could all act in concert doing our own roles.
You mentioned the water conditions as far as the temperatures and the number of passengers that you had to then get off the plane. What role did you play in helping them to safety?
Well, the evacuation began immediately. I opened the cockpit door and shouted the word evacuate, but it was already underway. Passengers opened overwing exits. The flight attendants opened the four doors. The evacuation was quick. A lot of cooperative behavior. We had an elderly woman who had been boarded in a wheelchair who needed to be assisted out by passengers and crew. We had a young family of four, including the youngest passenger, a 9-month-old child, who had to be helped out. And they were not seated together. They were two in one row and two in another. So it went well. Fortunately, New York Waterway, on their own initiative, they saw us approaching the river and radioed their ferries to turn toward us, and the first one was there very quickly, and that was incredibly important on such a cold day. By the time I left the airplane as the last one off, the rescue was well underway.
Captain Sullenberger will be at the 23rd Annual American Red Cross Evening of Stars. It's the largest local fundraiser to support Red Cross services such as blood donation, disaster assistance, and military family support. The event is 7 o'clock Thursday, April 21st at the Marriott in Uptown Normal, and we'll tell you about tickets coming up in just a moment. Captain Sullenberger, I've been following many of your interviews since that 2009 event. One of the things that you've brought up, not only safety with birds, which is something a lot of people did not know about, but also there are a lot of pilots out there that are working for smaller airlines. It is not a career where you become rich in many cases. In fact, pay is very low for our captains and our those in the flight industry.
Yeah, we hit a low after the 2001 terror attacks and the resulting airline bankruptcies in the early 2000s. I took a 40% pay cut. My first officer, Jeff Giles, because he'd lost his job as a captain and was backed into the first officer seat, took a 60% pay cut. Almost every airline employee in the country has had their pension terminated and replaced by a pennies on the dollar PPGC guarantee. Just recently, especially as a result of the recent mergers, airline pilot pay has begun at the largest airlines to get a bit better. At the regionals, as you point out, the starting pay is at starvation level wages, food stamp level wages, and that's just not a way to get people to choose a career path that requires a big investment in energy and time and money to get the required licenses and experience, even if it might eventually pay off in the end. So it is a good career, but we do need to do a much better job at the smaller regional airlines at having wages and working conditions and progression that will attract the best and brightest that we need to fill our cockpits and to make sure that every passenger has a crew who can handle whatever situation might suddenly arise.
That was Chesley Sully Sullenberger with Terry James. The Weekend News is next. This WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. Governor Rauner is giving lawmakers a couple of choices to fix the state's budget mess, go along with the reforms to bring structural changes to grow the economy in exchange for GOP support for tax increases, or give the executive branch broader authority to manage the state's limited resources. Rauner says the option of no reforms with broader budget authority is only a short-term fix.
It's not my preferred course of action. It wouldn't solve our long-term challenges. But it would, at the very least, allow us to stop digging the hole deeper.
Rauner says lawmakers need to stop wasting time on budget bills they know will get vetoed. Gail Hamilton, a home care worker who lives in Springfield but grew up in Bloomington, says the governor calling for another $200 million in cuts for home health care assistance is ludicrous.
So many people depend on this service to stay in their home, and it allows them to also be part of the community and, you know, put into the economy where they live.
And in reaction to the budget address, State Representative Dan Brady says Rauner has backed away from some of his reform proposals since last year.
We can negotiate what those 1 or 2 or 3 points may be with the Democrats and the Speaker, and the governor can debate that and can work through that.
A project which the town of Normal plans to help fund with a $10 million bond issuance approved this week is Phase 2 of the One Uptown Circle development. City Manager Mark Peterson says that project involves a 5-story residential building adjacent to the new Hyatt Hotel in Uptown.
When the council committed to that full development now, 5 or 6 years ago, they committed to a certain amount of financial assistance between the two. So we committed $5.1 million to the hotel project, and there's $2.8 million left over for Phase 2.
Peterson says the project will also involve some office and retail space, while some of that funding will also go toward a new fire station. The McLean County Board has added a new member and is losing one, too. Scott Murphy of Downs was appointed unanimously to serve the remainder of Matt Sorensen's term as he awaits trial on wire fraud charges. The 57-year-old Murphy runs a seed equipment business in Lexington. While there are fewer in agriculture on the board than there once were, Murphy says that's not necessarily his main focus.
I'm not coming here with an agenda to say I'm going to make sure that agriculture gets this and this. I'm coming here as a farmer because it's what I am.
Murphy is running for the four-year term in November. The board has another vacancy as Paul Finch, a first-termer from Normal, has taken a job in Madison, Wisconsin. The Heartland Community College Board has approved a 1.4% tuition increase. WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports that amounts to $2 per credit hour more for students.
Vice President of Business Services Doug Minter says uncertainties in state funding are the main reason for the change.
As we're trying to mitigate the risks associated with uncertainty, anything we can do to enhance revenue we think is important. And if the state would not come through for us, then this will help prepare us for that possibility.
The increase means students will begin paying $144 per credit hour beginning next semester. Minter adds the college spoke with its Student Government Association about this possibility, and while they would obviously like to see no increase, Minter says the students understand the tough position Heartland is in. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
And healthcare groups are pushing state lawmakers to raise the smoking age in Illinois. The legislation filed this week would make it a crime for anyone under the age of 21 to buy cigarettes. The current age is 18. Kathy Dre, vice president of the American Lung Association, says it could be difficult to enforce.
There really isn't a lot to stop people from doing that, but that doesn't happen very often. We've answered that, you know, about cigarette tax increases and other laws that we've passed in Illinois, and that just really doesn't happen very often, particularly with younger people.
The proposal would cover the purchase of all tobacco products, including electronic cigarettes. Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Bloomington City Manager David Hales will present his budget proposal to the City Council for the budget year that starts May 1st. On Tuesday, former McLean County Sheriff's Deputy Jay Hobson faces sentencing on charges that he stole $100,000 from the union representing sheriff's deputies. Also Tuesday, Hayworth's Village Board is expected to hold a special meeting regarding the firing of Police Chief Chris Lane. On Friday, State Farm is scheduled to issue its annual financial report. And this Friday and Saturday, Redbird Arena will play host to the girls' Class 1A and 2A state basketball finals. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.